KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Nopa.
I'm from Pittsburgh.
I live in Ingleside.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, as the state contemplates water tunnels in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, we'll meet a farm family that's worked that land for generations.
We ship corn and wheat and various grains out of here in our trucking business.
Digging into the roots of the Delta. Then a Bay Area artist creates a day-long performance to provide a dozen people with lifelong memories.
So a lot of the work is around bringing 12 people who experience the world in really different ways to bring those 12 people together.
And more poetry from Youth Speaks to get us in the mood for this week's International Poetry Slam.
And you wonder why I cry when people ask, are you a boy or a girl? Maybe I don't know, and maybe that wouldn't be a problem if you didn't f***ing ask me.
Cross Currents is next. This week, we're focusing on the California Delta, the region just to the east of the Bay Area, between Sacramento and Stockton. Major California rivers drain there, and over decades of building dams and reservoirs and pumps, it's become the major hub of California's water system, a system that may change again if Governor Jerry Brown's controversial plans to build tunnels for water transport go through. It's not just the water flow that's been transformed here. This land used to be made up of tidal wetlands and marshes of tule grass. Today, there are nearly 60 islands surrounded by levees. Most of the land here is used for farming, and it's some of the richest farmland in the state. In this story from our archives, KALW's Lisa Morehouse takes us to meet two people whose families have deep roots in Delta agriculture.
I'm driving down a long road on Andrus Island in the Central Delta, headed for Kay Dix Farm. It's home to pear orchards, a packing shed, a business office, and some truck storage. The man in charge here is Daniel Wilson, whose family's farmed the Delta for generations. Wilson lives just down the road in a house built by his grandfather almost 100 years ago.
Now, we're going to take you into an orchard, and we're going to show you kind of different stages of growth.
We walk past the packing facility. It's quiet now, but in summer it buzzes with machines and people, washing, treating, and separating pears by size, wrapping them in tissue so the delicate fruit can withstand being shipped across the country. They grow several thousand tons of pears each year.
These are Bartlett pears. This was the entire river 30 years ago. Every single tree was this 30 years ago.
The winter orchard is filled with Medusa-like pear trees.
We've now diversified away from these trees, and we've gotten other varieties.
Using an age-old practice, they've grafted a pear called Stark Crimson onto stumps of old Bartlett trees because, Wilson says, new varietals can bring in almost twice as much as Bartlett pears right now.
One could argue we've diversified away from these so much that we're starting to go, oops, went too far. But that's farming. You change varieties, you try to see what's profitable.
Pears were one of the first commercial crops in the Delta.
I have trees next to my house. You can see those trees in the distance that are 130, 140 years old. Grandpa plants five different types of fruit, and the pears are the one that lived.
Why have people grown pears and other crops here for so long?
It's nice soil, it's rich in nutrients, and you know, it's close to population centers back in the day.
Back in the days of the gold rush. Many of the most successful people of the time weren't miners, but were instead the ones who sold food and supplies to the miners, says Wilson.
You wanted to be the guy selling the shovel, not the guy digging with the shovel.
While miners sought their fortunes in the hills, the state encouraged farmers to come to the Delta and basically turn part-time swampland into full-time farmland by building levees. That's how this area came to be what it is today.
So back in the 1850s, they passed the Arkansas Swamp and Reclamation Act, and they said, state, we'll give you this land here in these marshes in Arkansas and California if you give them to people and the people build levees around it and reclaim the land and turn it into productive farmland, then they can keep it. And that's when these reclamation districts are formed and the local farmers built the levees and kept the water back, and that's how agriculture developed in the Delta.
Agricultural infrastructure looked pretty different back then. In the 1920s and 30s, when fruit growing really picked up, Wilson says farmers here would take pears across the island to the Sacramento River, which is about a mile away.
They would load the fruit onto a schooner, and the schooner would pick up at various farms, and then it would turn around and head back down to San Francisco.
Labor was different, too. Today, most of the crews Wilson hires to pick and pack pears are Latino.
When I was a kid, every pear crew that worked around here was from the Philippines.
Filipinos were essential to Delta agriculture and were most famously linked with the asparagus crop. I drive over to a former labor camp on nearby Twitchell Island with 93-year-old Nicholas Cataño. He knows the history of Filipinos in the Delta firsthand.
This is practically all asparagus. All these fields right in here.
Cataño's Portuguese mother met his Filipino father on a plantation in Hawaii, where Cataño was born. When his paternal grandfather found better work in California, most of the family came here, including a one-year-old Nicholas. His family farmed and became labor contractors.
I supervise these fields here, yeah, as a labor contractor. Here's a packing shed, right here. He still has the machinery in there.
After showing me the field, Cataño directs me to his home, which sits atop a levee. It's stuffed with neatly hung, perfectly pressed clothes and fishing poles and old photographs.
I got a picture and then I want to show you if you had time to look at it, though.
One posed portrait shows well over 100 people, almost all young men. It was taken at a large gathering of Filipinos in Los Angeles.
These are all farmers and farm laborers in the Delta.
And they're dressed to the nines in fine suits. Most Filipinos in the Delta were men. In fact, the only women and children in the image belonged to Cataño's family, due in large part to his father's position as a labor contractor.
We had a lot of men. You know, they all came from all over, you know, from the Philippines, from the Hawaiian Islands, you know, from wherever they were urged to come here.
Cataño says his father organized crews of Filipino workers to move around the state, harvesting different crops. In the Delta, cutting asparagus, which they called grass, was back-breaking work.
And they would cut more or less about 4 acres each, 4 acres a day apiece, which was almost impossible to do. You had to have 2 or 3 knives all sharp all the time, you know, stone in your hand, always sharpening your knives.
And workers would place the hand-picked asparagus onto sleds, pulled by horses. There's still some asparagus grown in the Delta, but for the last couple decades, cheaper asparagus, imported from Mexico, has made many farmers here turn to other crops that make a higher profit and require less labor. Now, many of the fields that grew asparagus hold corn, alfalfa, and other crops that need just a combine and one driver for 100 acres. Daniel Wilson's one of those farmers. He gave up growing asparagus years ago, but he runs part of his business in a building connected to the crop's history in the Delta.
This facility you see hanging out over the water started its life as a Southern Pacific Railroad packing shed, or produce, by the way, for asparagus in specific. They would pack the asparagus and the entire river would be covered with asparagus butts.
Now it's a grain elevator, one of his family's many business endeavors. Along with farming and grain storage, they're in the transportation business, too.
We ship corn and wheat and various grains out of here in our trucking business. We also ship pears, our main crop, and wine grapes, and olives, and anything else we can think of. But those are our main products. Did I miss any? So those are our main things we haul out of the Delta.
It's all part of being a successful farming family, not depending solely on pears.
Any crop that you're totally devoted to makes you a little vulnerable to if the pears go bad, which they have in the late 40s and the 80s and times like that, then you want to diversify into other things.
Along with diversifying, farmers around the Delta are trying other strategies to stay viable. There's a huge farmers market at the intersection of two major highways, and it's filled with Delta wine and produce and stories about the farmers. Local businesses hand out tour maps for visitors to drive up the river and visit local farms along the way. Like Wilson, they want to keep farming here.
We have pretty deep roots here. We farm here because we can make good money and we like the area. I'm sure if you talk to a farmer in Dinuba or one in Oroville, they'd tell you the same thing. The dad farmed here and grandpa farmed here and so I'm farming here.
Wilson's children and nephews work for him, and he sees neighbors' kids still involved, especially on the business side of farming. He says there's not a lot of big ag here. Though he sees the number of owners getting smaller and their operations getting bigger, Wilson says there are few, if any, widely held corporations involved in farming in the Delta.
It's a complicated area to survive in. You have to take care of the levees, you have to take care of the drainage. We're regulated much more heavily than a lot of other areas.
Every farmer I talk to in the Delta has concerns about the state's proposed Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which would build tunnels at the north end of the Delta to ship water across the state. They have questions about how much farmland would be lost to tunnel construction and wetland restoration, and about the quality of the Delta water. Daniel Wilson shares these concerns, but in the meantime, he's sticking to what his family's done for over a century.
I love to farm. I like this area. I like to grow things. So if we can figure out how to make money doing something we love to do, then we've got our questions answered.
In the Delta, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That story is the second in a series exploring the California Delta. We'll be airing more this week, and you can find them all right now at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area choreographer and director Erica Chong Shuck has been making all kinds of performance work ever since she discovered her love for it at UC Santa Cruz over two decades ago. She's presented work in theaters for more than 1,000 people, but her latest work is for an audience of just 12. It's what she calls an intimate adventure, both personal and collaborative. Erica Chong Shuck spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney about the origins of her work.
Your current project, For You, is about making pieces for selected audiences of about 12 people each. So first off, what does that even mean?
Oh, gosh. Okay. What does that mean? That means that we select a group of 12 people, exactly 12 people, exactly 12, and we spend about 2 months with them. We go out, we basically date them for a couple of months. We visit them in their houses, or we take them out for, you know, boba tea or beer or coffee, or
you
we
woo
meet
them.
At the park. We woo them.
We get to know them.
We do. We woo them and we get to know them. And we think a lot about how to make a performance piece for them that can basically be a gift for them.
So where did you get this idea to do a performance art gift like that?
My grandparents, their names were Phyllis and Milton, and they lived in San Jose, and I think that they were my biggest fans ever, and they would come to see every single work that I ever created, and they would drive up from San Jose, and they would park in like the Mission, you know, where I did a lot of work at the old intersection for the arts on 16th and Valencia, and they would come to every single work. They would get there half hour early, and they would watch every single piece, and at the end of the work, they would always say, "We don't understand it, but we love you." Every single piece, "We don't understand it, honey, but we love you," and they would say, "Go, champ." And they did this until they couldn't anymore. They both got old, as we do, and they ended up spending more time at home, and it was harder for them to come up to the city. And so they spent most of their time in their living room in these chairs. There are two chairs that were side by side. And I had the idea of making a performance piece for them in which we think about the music of their lives, and we were going to sing songs that were relevant to their life. And we were going to stage it in their homes where they could sit in their chairs, and we would perform like in their backyard under the apple tree that they could see from their chairs, or we would, you know, wheel them to their bedroom. And so I just thought about making something for them, and they ended up passing away. And so I wasn't able to do it, but I just got very excited.
Oh,
about
that's so heartbreaking.
I know, they would have loved it. They just would have loved it. But I just loved the creative ideas that came when I really thought, what would Phyllis love? What would Milton love? The piece has to include like latkes. It has to include like porn for my grandpa. Sorry, Milton. You know, there's just certain things that are very specific to them and their lives and their lifestyle. And it was really liberating creatively to think about, to give them an experience that would be the most meaningful.
That's director and choreographer Erica Chong Shuck. Her latest work is called For You. So what happens in the course of a performance of For You with these 12 select audience members?
Yeah, so in our April 1st performance, we had a day-long performance event that began at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And we traveled to the Marin Headlands, and we had a series of performance events, which included some one-on-one performances, some group performances, a dinner, a dance on the beach. And the goal was really to give these 12 people an experience that would introduce them to each other.
But within that group setting, performances are individualized?
There are moments that are individualized, and there are moments that are shared. So a lot of the work is around bringing 12 people who experience the world in really different ways to bring those 12 people together.
So they haven't known each other before.
They haven't. I mean, some of them had, but that was not intentional.
Uh-huh. And what makes you want to do this work? You've been in the San Francisco Bay Area for quite a while. What makes you want to do this work here?
Oh, that's a great question. I think this is something that I want to say about the Bay Area. My mom is a Korean immigrant. She had a liquor store in Richmond in the East Bay. And this liquor store that she had was kind of like this community center, right? She's a Korean woman in this primarily African-American neighborhood. And the people that came through this liquor store came through because they wanted to have time with my mom. So there would be two counters at the liquor store, and the line behind my mom's cash register would always be like super, super long. And the other guy would probably, like, nobody would be in his line because everybody wanted to just have a moment with my mom. So, and the kinds of people that wanted to talk to her were like from all walks of life, right? So I just remember being pretty young and like working at the liquor store like on Sundays and just seeing one person after another come and talk to my mom about like their deepest, darkest things that were happening in their life. And I just loved that this sense of community, that this community center could be established at this liquor store where people would come in and like cash their checks and, you know, buy a cigar and, you know, buy a candy bar. And that there was this really unexpected sense of connection. And I think that the Bay Area has so many places like that. I went to a donut shop in the Tenderloin where I've been going to this donut shop for 20 years. I used to live on Mission between 6th and 7th. And I think it's the same lady that's been at this donut shop for all of this time. And you just sit down and you have this conversation about life and about living. And there are all of these little pockets in San Francisco that are like almost like wormholes to the way it was. And I guess I'm just at this time in my life where those wormholes are really meaningful because they're taking me back to who I was. They're taking me back to a city that I grew up in, and the sense of wanting to make work that is meaningful, wanting to live a life that is driven by my own kind of principles. I think so much of that is connected to growing up in the Bay Area and having a family of activists and liquor store owner therapists.
That was choreographer and director Erica Chong-Shuk speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. Applications for You are open through August 15th. Find a link to apply at our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The International Youth Poetry Slam Festival, Brave New Voices, comes to the Bay Area this week with workshops, town halls, and, of course, poetry slams in Oakland and Berkeley. The Grand Slam takes place Saturday at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House. We're getting primed with poems this week from Youth Speaks. Here's Ash Phillips performing An Open Letter to Cis People.
An Open Letter to Cis People. Ladies and gentlemen, someone once mentioned a door. A door opening out, heterosexual. A door opening in, homosexual. A door opening both ways, bisexual. Pansexual, revolving door. Door locked, but one person has the key. Demisexual. Asexuality, that door is really a brick wall. Cisgender, noun. The opposite of transgender, shortened to cis. Someone who is cisgender doesn't worry when walking into a public restroom for fear of being attacked or reported. Gender dysphoria, noun. The conditioning feeling one's emotional and psychological identity as male or female to be opposite to one's biological sex. Gender dysphoria is binding your breasts just to walk out of the house. It's your friend saying, I want to rip my boobs off of my chest. Discrimination. Noun, the act of discriminating. Discriminating, adjective, liking only things that are of good quality. Quality, noun, a high level of value or excellence. To you, our gender dysphoria is a bad quality that lowers our value as a person. And you wonder why I cry when people ask, are you a boy or a girl? I'm neither, or maybe I'm both, or maybe I don't know, and maybe that wouldn't be a problem if you didn't f***ing ask me. So I have some news for you, cis people. You aren't the only people that exist. I know, I just turned your whole world upside down, so take a sec to think your life over. But now that I have your attention again, you must be thinking something. How is this possible? Fear not, cis people. I will be your pride prophet, your gay guru, your bisexual Buddha, your asexual Abraham, your demisexual Dalai Lama, and your pansexual Pope. So hear me, cis people. I, your messenger of the queers, shall guide thee through these troubling times. The world isn't black and white, and it never was. It was always pink and blue. Give yourself some new colors, like red, for the blood of our lost trans family this last year. Goddess Edwards, Lamia Beard, Ty Underwood, Yasmin Payne, Taha DeJesus, Penny Proud, Bree Golick, Christina Reinwald, Sumaya Yissel. You weren't killed by black and white. It was pink and blue who took your lives. Leela Alcorn, Xander Mahaffey, Ash Hafner. You are three people in the 41% of trans suicides every year. I know only one other person who knows your names. When a room of 40 can't get that right, what else am I supposed to do? Why were some ancient civilizations more accepting than today's? Why are black people the highest population in the trans community but the least represented? Why will 64% of transgender people be sexually assaulted in their lifetime? Why do the majority only get their rights infringed upon when it involves the oppressed reclaiming theirs? Cis people, when you ignore preferred pronouns, you're telling someone they are not good enough. You're saying your identity inconveniences me when I talk to or about you, so I'm gonna say whatever I want and you can deal with it. A pronoun for you is nothing more than what your chromosomes made you, but for us, a pronoun is an identity. A pronoun is a symbol. A pronoun is not who we are, but they are all we have in this pink and blue world. There are 74 pronouns in the English language. Only 8 of them are based on sex. Learn to use the other 66. Someone's life could depend on it.
That was Youth Speaks poet Ash Phillips performing An Open Letter to Cis People back in the 2015 Brave New Voices Grand Slam. The Poetry Festival returns to the Bay this week. See what's happening at bravenewvoices.org. And that's all for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Andy Bosselman, Nina Gensler-Deb, Sonia Hudson, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Judy Silber, Jackie Sajiko, Andrew Stelzer, and Laura Wenes. Cross Currents is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by a San Francisco tradition, the Golden Gate Park Band. This is the band's 135th season. The Golden Gate Park Band performs every Sunday into October. As always, this week's free concert takes place in the Spreckles Temple of Music in Golden Gate Park. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.